scientists have made the study and the experiment. Like, people would actually feel bad for the butterfly because now it's ready to come out of its cocoon. So they would open the cocoon for it. They would slice it open to make it easier for the butterfly to come out. And it turns out that even doing that weakens the butterfly after that, because that effort of breaking the cocoon and spreading your wings is the necessity to become more resilient and stronger in life.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. This conversation is with Daniel Fox. Daniel is a photographer, a solo wilderness explorer, and the author of Feel the Wild, an intimate and powerful story about nature and our relationship with it. Daniel and I spoke early in the pandemic, mostly about nature, how it heals, how it teaches, and why we so desperately need it right now. On this very last day of this very strange year, this episode serves as a reminder to connect with ourselves, with one another, and with nature. I think it's how we heal, how we start over, and how we remember who we are and why we're here. Happy New Year. Let's hope it's a better one. Hi, Daniel. How are you doing?
Excellent. Excellent. And you?
Really good. Because you do many things, and you write, you speak, you think about nature, wildlife, you're a wildlife photographer, you go on these incredible expeditions. When somebody says, like when you meet somebody and they ask what you do, how do you answer it?
It's kind of a struggle that I've had for quite some time. And actually, it kind of got resolved lately when my wife and I, we were on a car ride driving back from Napa. We had a dinner with friends, and the host was struggling, trying to introduce me. You're this and you're that. Like, what am I supposed to be introducing you as? As I was explaining all the different things that I was doing, my wife kind of connected the dots, and she's like, well, it sounds like an ape. You're, an artist, an author, photographer, philosopher, and an explorer and entrepreneur. And really the light went on, and I'm like, yes, I'm an ape. Not only figuratively, but literally. I'm this descendant of my lineage.
You grew up with moving all the time, and you were
correct,
but felt very connected to nature. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So, I mean, by the age of 12, we've had already moved 10 times, and I grew up having to reinvent my surrounding, the world around me. I mean, I would make friends, I would lose friends. Houses, became kind of momentary backdrops for my life. But everywhere that we moved, there was always a local park, a local forest, or a place where, a shore. And nature became my constant, my anchor. It was the place where I went to, and things didn't kind of change. It was my stability. Throughout the rest of my life, that sense of connectedness and groundness have always stayed with me. It's where I go back to make some sense of the world. It's where I go back to resource myself. It's where I go back to kind of reconnect with everything.
So when you really reconnected later and really just turned your whole life upside down, in a sense, it was like you were kind of going home in a way.
There's a simplicity in the wilderness, because I tend not to make a difference between nature and life. For me, life is nature, nature is life. They're two of the same. Now, wilderness is a destination, but there's a simplicity. Nothing is pretty, nothing is ugly, nothing is good, nothing is bad. Everything has a reason, whether you like it or you don't. And your needs, you know, also become extremely simple. You need shelter, you need to eat, you need to protect yourself. And you start to realize that every single species is caught in that survival. And everything is connected, but we're all trying to survive in our own ways. So every time that I would be in the human world and things seem to be too complicated or too overwhelming, then I would head back to the wilderness, to nature, and be reminded of the simplicity of life.
And kind of refueled and reconnected. So what happened? So you were working in New York and yeah. Was there like a moment? Did something happen that you said, I can't do this anymore?
There was. I have a side of me that loves big cities. I mean, I've lived in New York City, in LA, San Francisco, Buenos Aires, Munich, Montreal, and now I'm in Vancouver. But I've always loved the creative buzz, the depth of culture. There's something that is absolutely incredible about big cities. But also I have this side of me that, you know, is perfectly fine in a shack by the ocean just by myself. So when I grew up, my teenage dreams were to sail the world and study whales and work with animals. I remember the first time I applied to university was at UBC, University of British Columbia, and I wanted to be a marine biologist, but I didn't make it. So I ended up in going to marketing business. And that, you know, slowly led me to New York City.
Right.
And I lived in New York City for 7 years. It's just that I wasn't motivated. The chase was more interesting than what I got in the end. And to fast forward, make a long story short, I found myself at the place where I was at the end of a really bad relationship, and I reassessed everything that I had and how I wanted to move forward. And there was literally nothing that I wanted to keep. And I remember asking myself the question, like, would I rather continue in New York City, or would I prefer being in a little cabin in the middle of nowhere? And the answer back then was cabin in the middle of nowhere. And this is when I basically sold everything. And I took out a world map and I put my finger on New York and I went as far south as possible and I ended up in Argentina. And this is where I went for 6 months. And this is where I reconnected myself with what I want to do and what I do now. I started to photograph and to write, and what I photographed and what I write really resonated with people.
You had a moment there, right, in Argentina that made you really realize this is it. This is my life now.
Yeah, I was on the beach, and there was just this moment of awakening where, like, I took this breath, and it just kind of opened something. That moment on the beach where, like, that, it's like waking up again, you know, coming to this world, but now you're aware of it.
See, I think those kind of moments, the moments that really tell us who we are or where we should be or could be or how we could be or who we want to be in the world, I think it's a human experience. But I think the tricky thing is it's very easy to not give them credit and keep doing what you're doing. And so giving that moment the credit, I'm sure, is part of what led you to this incredible existence that you live now, where taking the moment very seriously, this is my path.
Life is always trying to send you these insights, these messages. But when we're constantly chasing our own tails, when we're constantly banging ourselves into noise, even if these messages, even if these insights are there, or even if these moments of these aha moments are there, you'll never be able to hear them or to see them because you're constantly overwhelmed by everything else.
Yeah.
So you really need to create that space. I mean, there's a story that I, like in the mentorship that I do and the presentations that I make about transformation. And I make the parallel with the butterfly, how, like, we tell each other that we have this capacity to be our own butterfly and soar and spread our wings. But we forget that before becoming that butterfly, the caterpillar has to really isolate itself. It has to consciously create a cocoon around itself so that it can transform. That is so important, because otherwise there's no transformation. You're always going to be running after something, chasing something. So you need to create those boundaries.
Well, and it's hard work. So I think it's an easy thing to want to avoid.
Absolutely. I mean, it's transformation is not something that we want. It's something that's imposed on us. Change is not something that we go after. I mean, for the vast majority of people, it's just something that it's inevitable. Things will change. But what makes us great as a human species is our capacity to adapt, to learn from our mistakes. But life is a messy process. You know, there's a lot of disruption and tension involved.
So was your 6 months in Argentina then, was that like your cocoon?
I would say that the transformation had started a while ago. Argentina was the tipping point where finally I accepted my path, my direction, but there was still a lot of work to be done. And this is, you know, if to make the parallel again with the butterfly. In fact, scientists have made the study and the experiment, like people would actually feel bad for the butterfly because now it's ready to come out of its cocoon. So they would open the cocoon for it. They would slice it open to make it easier for the butterfly to come out. And it turns out that even doing that weakens the butterfly after that, because that effort of breaking the cocoon and spreading your wings is the necessity to become more resilient and stronger in life. So when I got to Argentina and I got reborn again, there was an entire world around me that I needed to change. It's not because my brain had accepted the new direction, that everything, the momentum that I was carrying with me knew exactly where to go. I really had to stop that momentum and start again into the direction that I want to go.
Was this your first big solo adventure expedition?
It was a disaster. I had this ridiculous idea of kayaking my way around the world. And I guess the size and the grand scale of the plan just like represents how far down I'd come. It just, for me, like it was the upswing of the place that I was in. But I was able to get sponsorship. I guess this is where my marketing background, my business savvy came in, but I was able to get a kayak, and you know, I think back then it was $25,000 worth of equipment of gear. And I got to Argentina and I left Mar del Plata, which is a town on the Atlantic coast of Argentina, and I was so ill prepared. It was the worst. I got into this kayak and I could barely float because I had too much equipment. And there were these people I got to know when I was over there, and they were all at the marina, like wishing me goodbye. And I was, in my head, I was freaking out because I knew that at any moment I could actually capsize and I would look ridiculous. So I'm paddling out of the marina and I'm like, just please, please, please don't capsize. And I'm paddling out and I'm running this jetty, which usually there will always have this humongous waves. I finally make it across and I start paddling, and I cover in 3 days the amount of distance that I had planned in one day. Like I was barely making any progress. I had injured my wrist. Nothing was working the way that I wanted. The kayak that I had, it was not really the right kayak for these kind of waters. And after 3 days, I reached my limit and I landed on this tourist beach and I walked straight into a hotel. I checked in and I'm like, this is not going to work. I have to reassess everything. So I rented this small car, put the kayak on the top, and I just drove down to, I drove 12 hours and I drove to Valdez Peninsula. And this is where I stayed for 6 months and really reconnected with what I want to do.
And what'd you do in those 6 months?
I kayaked, photographed, camped, met people. And it's really with the people there that also I discovered this place of Argentina. And this is, you know, this is one thing that has become part of my creative process and part of the ways that I capture these places. It would be arrogant for me to think that I can truly capture the spirit of these locations by being a visitor. My first step is always to connect with people, to start a relationship, to friends. And it's through them after that that I get to experience these locations.
So you were already a photographer at that point when you started.
Photography was more of a hobby for me, not a professional photographer. The arrival of digital photography definitely helped me craft my photography and create my own signature of what I want to do.
All of your photography, it's got this power where it makes you feel very connected and isolated at the same time. Like the bigness of the world and connected to the world is how I felt looking through it.
Thank you.
One thing that really interests me too in your book, you said, talking about photographing wildlife.
Yes.
And I just thought this was awesome and I want to hear more about it, but I'll read this paragraph from there that says, "When I photograph wildlife, I don't hide from them. I want them to see me. Through my photos, I seek to create totems. My goal is to capture their inner spirit, their energy. I want to acknowledge and celebrate a creature that has successfully carved itself a niche in the tree of evolution. I want to connect with them in the same manner that a student looks up to his teacher. I want to look into their eyes and I want them to look into mine. There is so much for me, for us to learn from them. When I press the shutter, there isn't me, the human, and it, the wild animal, rather there is us, two creatures sharing this space, breathing the same air, doing what we can to survive and protect the ones that we care and love." Okay, it's 100% beautiful, but how do you do this? Because that whole incident, which I want to hear about as well, with the bear,
yes,
that you talk about in your book, it's almost like you wait and kind of like let them know, hey, I'm here and we're going to connect before I start. Do many people do this? And talk to me about this a little bit, because this is fascinating and incredible.
It's just, you know, it's mind blowing. When I go out there, I go out there with the understanding and the knowledge that the world is bigger than me. I'm just another species bounded by time, mortality, and the limit of my body and my, you know, and everything else. And there's a certain humility and acceptance, vulnerability that I go out with. And when I photograph animals, I want to honor their own survival success. And I want the camera to be more of a witness rather than the purpose. And it's, you know, it's catching an informal bond between two species. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't happen all the time. The vast majority of the times when I make myself, you know, visible and present, animals will just like go away or leave. But by making myself visible and by making them aware of what I'm doing and why I'm there, then the moment is more of a relationship, a participation. For me, the eyes are really important. I want that presence. I want those eyes. I want that power, that depth of spirit. And I think that there's an inherent curiosity in all organisms in the world, even more so within the mammals, I think. And at the beginning, there's always this informal dance. You know, there's so much information because we want to assess our surrounding. We want to know what is a threat and what is not a threat. And the voice is a powerful tool. And this is one of the reasons why when I'm out there, I always talk to myself and I always talk to the animals. Not that I feel that they understand it, but that I'm aware that my voice is carrying my state of mind or my intentions to the world.
because this is how you've photographed so many animals, like, have you had experiences that really were, like, where animals were really curious and were kind of incredible or, you know, totally surprising?
Oh, yeah. Well, so there was one, I was on Antelope Island in Utah, and I had gotten special permission from the warden to basically go off the beaten path and go and hang out with the buffaloes or the bisons. What I would usually do is I would identify a group of males, you know, they hang out by 2, 3, 4 of them. And I would kind of gauge the direction that they're taking. And then I would go way ahead and I would sit in the grass. And then I would wait. I would wait to see, you know, if they come my way, if they don't. I remember this giant one coming. And like, he saw me from really far away. But he came slowly, zigzagging, and he would look up. And then he ended up actually like passing by, I don't know, it was like 10 feet away from me, 10, 15 feet away from me. And I'm sitting on the ground. My eyes are the same height as his eyes. And on top of that, he was wearing this little branch that he had picked up while eating. And it looks like he's wearing a crown. And I had this moment of I felt like this was a king, this ancestral king who had ruled the plains, who was just passing in front. There was a depth of time in his eyes that was just so profound. I've had that with seals. I had that sea lions. I had that with bears. Moments where it just, like, for me, there was something bigger than just, you know, the physicality of the animal.
Do you ever get scared?
I do. I mean, yes. Okay. For me, you have.
Good.
It's normal to be scared. Fears, or when you're scared, then you have a choice. And you have to understand the dynamics of those fears and why they, you know, why they show up. It's outside of our comfort zone. It's the unknown, the uncertainty. But it's after that. I mean, I wrote recently, you know, with what's happening, the difference between fears and dangers. Dangers are real. Dangers are something that you can analyze, you can study, you can find solutions to. But fears are our interpretation of those dangers. And our interpretations are rooted in our own assessment of what is a comfort zone and what is not. Our own reaction to dangers is as much important as to the danger itself, because the world feeds on that. If you go, and this is, you know, this is one of the reasons why I don't carry firearms when I go out. If the world around you senses that you're coming armed to the teeth, then the reaction was just, well, you're a threat, and I'm going to arm myself to the teeth. But if you go and you recognize that moment where, like, okay, I sense myself like starting to be afraid, but let's take a deep breath. Let's just like relax 2 seconds. I know I have the capacity to get out of this, or I know I have the capacity. This is not as bad as it is. Let me just take a deep breath.
Well, and you're still here, so.
Yes, there's a big difference. I mean, I'm not an adrenaline junkie. I don't like, and this is a reality also when you do solo wilderness expeditions. You don't have the luxury to really push the boundaries as if you were with other people. There's a lack of approving to each other when you're with other people. But there's also that if something happens, there's no one to, I mean, you're on your own. So you kind of have to be careful of what you do. So I don't go after risk just for the fun of it. I find myself in situation that I think people see as extremely risky. But again, you know, it's a perception. When I was in Argentina, I remember being on the Great Plains, flooded plains of Corrientes, which is this province in Argentina. And I was with gauchos, you know, the equivalent of cowboys here. And there were snakes and alligators everywhere. And it was just like, I mean, for us, we just felt that death was everywhere. And that was their playground. You know, they really loved it. And they were the ones telling us that we were the crazy ones because we lived in cities with cars zooming by and, you know, accidents left and right and overwhelmed by millions of people. That was outside of their comfort zone. So from their perspective, that was dangerous. So, you know, two different perspectives, two different views, and yet, like, there's a reality of dangers, but the fears are totally different.
Just to get back to the animal yeah. encounters for a minute, you also talk about equality in your book and how with animals, they should be respected for their own sake. That also made me very happy because I don't think that's something people talk about enough. I think a lot of humans tend to talk about animals in how important they are to us or why we need them or why we like them, or but not in the sense that they're important for their own sake. They're important. They're important amongst themselves.
There's a righteousness in our attitude towards nature. I mean, and, you know, even conservation, if there is one big failure of the conservation movement has been to approach nature in a righteous way. Like, we have to save nature. The perspective that we have towards saving the planet right now is nothing different than Noah saving the animals. It's us being at the top of this, you know, this garden, and it's our duty to manage and save the poor little animals who need our protection, you know, to survive. And if we're not there to save it, then life will cease to exist. It's, you know, it doesn't work like that. We are a product of our environment. Do we want to live in the world of complexities and richness where other species like live and thrive? Or do we want to live in a sanitized and sterile environment? Every animal plays a role in this complex web of discoveries and hidden treasures and like amazing things. And you cannot just take one out and say, well, this one is undesirable and I don't want it. It's just that everybody's connected to so many different things.
In terms of saving the planet, and one of the reasons I think that we've let the planet go on so many levels is because so many people don't actually have a real connection to nature anymore, just not spending any time in it, but also not really allowing it.
This is one of the points that I often debate is it's more about us, not about nature. Nature continues. Whether a volcano erupts tomorrow and blankets the entire earth, whether right. a rock falls from the sky and destroys everything, nature is not there saying, oh, you know, it's bad. It just kind of resets the game and continues. We're the ones realizing that we don't feel comfortable about the way things are moving forward. And so the decision is not about, do we want to save the planet? Do we want to save ourselves? Do we want to save a lifestyle that is part of something that is bigger? If you change that perspective, I personally think that it would make it more attractive for people, because everybody's trying to put food on the table. Everybody's trying to send their kids to school. Everybody wakes up in the morning and try to do the right thing for their family, for themselves. So to be told that we're a bad species, that we're constantly bad and bad, it's not inspiring. Nobody wants it. No one wants to be told constantly that they're bad people. No. We have to point the finger into the future and say, all right, now it's, you know, we have to reassess how we want to move forward. How do we build the future? And this is what our society and culturally we're going through right now. We know that our relationship with the planet is broken. There's no denial about it, but we just don't know how to move forward because it forces us to reassess everything, to question everything that we take for granted. But the inevitable happens. Change will be forced. Like right now, what we're going through, it's been forced and it's been imposed on us. But we realize that we have this capacity, this resilience to rise up when, you know, when life pushes us down. And this is, for me, there's a beauty and profoundness to these moments where, like, you see the beauty of life. You see people coming together. You see the things that we thought was impossible becoming possible. And that's nature. That's life.
Right now with the pandemic, and people are really forced, pretty much all over the planet, are really forced to not only look at their own lives, because there's just there's a lot more stillness happening. People are stuck. They're inside. All the distractions are kind of melting away because they're not available. On a personal level, but also on a kind of planetary global level, how do you think like the pandemic, as being part of this catalyst for change, can you talk about that a little?
Oh, it's a definite catalyst. It's a definite, you know, there's no escape in on what's going on. We can argue on whether, you know, we are here because of the strength of the virus or the weakness of our society, the why. But the truth is that we're here. And it's you look back at history, and history is full of those moments that were catalysts for transformation and that's the process of growth and evolution. I do believe that suffering, pain, destruction, tension, disruption, they are the incentive for transformation and growth. Because otherwise, when you're happy, there's no incentive to move forward. You just want actually to stay put and enjoy the moment. It's really when you're put outside of your comfort zone that you're forced to fix something. But it's this uncertainty of life that brings a certain humility, and it reminds us of what's important in the world.
And we're here now.
And we're here now. and you know, we had this point where, you know, there's going to be some amazing things coming out of that. There's going to be some awful things. We have 8 billion, soon to be 8 billion people on the planet. You cannot have all these people at one table and everybody's going to agree. But there's going to be amazing growth and transformation. There's going to be some losers. There's going to be some winners. And this is, you know, this is even one issue that I have with climate change, is that the way that we're trying to fight it is with this really static idea of what the world is supposed to look like. But the thing, the truth about climate change is that it's reshuffling the cards of power. Who has it? Who doesn't? There are certain people on the planet who really are welcoming climate change because it makes their lives better. So even if you have the capacity to rewind and say, well, we need to, you know, to go back to that moment, there are certain people who are going to be like, no, because now they're starting to enjoy it, you know, more than what they used before. I mean, right, you know, I'm in Vancouver. On Vancouver Island, you have people now who have 2-3 harvests a year when they used to have only one harvest, because, you know, the rise of temperatures really has been a benefit for them. So even if you have a machine to go back, they're going to be like, no.
Sure.
I like that. But if we move the debate into, it's not about climate change, it's not about the rise of temperature, it's about our relationship with the planet, about how we do things, how we cannot just take, but we need to have this relationship with the world.
For so many people, they don't have this relationship. How does that happen, that they just decide that they have a relationship?
It happens, and unfortunately, there's not an easy answer. It happens when the things that you took for granted are taken away from you. That's the unfortunate reality of, like, becoming wiser as you get older, is because the things that you took for granted when you grew up, suddenly you realize that it's not really easy. And you're forced to reassess what matters in life. I have this theory why, like, when we go to Europe, meals and food is so important, and why work is not at the center of their lives. It's because there's not one inch or centimeter of Europe that hasn't been conquered, destroyed, lost over and over, you know, over again and again through generations. And when these things, when you have this recurrence of suffering, when the things that you took for granted are taken away from, you know, from you by players that are bigger than you, then what are you left with? You're left with bread and the community. And if you have bread and community, then you have hope. So you create rituals around them to remind yourself that the world could be falling apart around you. But if you're at the table with friends and families, and if you have bread to break, then it's not that bad.
It's true.
And this is one of the things that we're discovering right now, is that, great, we have our job, or, you know, we had our jobs. We had this idea of what the world was supposed to be and all the conveniences. But now we realize that, hey, I can have a certain meaning in my life with the simplicity and the little things that this pandemic has brought forward. And we're forced to reassess what is important to us. So now, I started gardening. My wife is cooking a lot more. It's really like we're rediscovering the little simple things that make life so rich.
And that is the gift in all of this for so many.
Yeah, and it really doesn't want to diminish the suffering, no, the pain and the losses that everybody is experiencing. I mean, I just had, you know, news of a friend who just lost her mother to COVID-19 yesterday. And it is tragic. There's no denying about it. But we have to understand what we're capable of doing through that pain and suffering. And this is what brings the light at the end of the tunnel. It makes us come together. Not letting yourself go down a dark rabbit hole by what is going on doesn't mean that, like, we're not taking this seriously. It's just that we're seeing the potential for something better out of these dark moments.
Yeah.
We're extremely resilient. Life is resilient. Nature is resilient. And there's a light at the end of the tunnel. And, you know, we talk about failures in our career, how failures are important. Well, failures are important in society. They're extremely important. They have their purpose. They're hard, but they have a purpose.
There's something pretty incredible about the entire world going through the same crisis at the same moment. It's not just one society. It's like society everywhere.
Yeah, India's got clean air now. They get to see the mountains. And, you know, I have Mount Baker in the background. It doesn't take a lot in terms of the planet, for nature. It doesn't take a lot to go back to a certain sense of natural rhythm. The birds continue to sing.
Daniel, this has been incredible and such good things to think about.
If there's one thing that I want people to take with them, is that nature is this world of insights and teachings and lessons. And it's a framework for personal and collective transformation. And if we're able to look at nature not as this place that needs to be managed and protected and saved, but rather as this world that is bigger than us, with these dynamics and lessons that we can apply to our own journey, then we'll find comfort in that journey. You know, we're not going to try to fight it, but rather trying to experience it and grow from it.
How can people learn more about you and follow you?
My book is out, Feel the Wild. They can go on my website, danielfox.co, not com, but .co. I'm on social media, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram. I have my nonprofit, wild.eco, which we raise funds to send disadvantaged students to month-long wilderness camps. Also have a mentorship. It's a year-long program where every month we have a theme, and it's really to give people the tools to experience life.
Good. Okay. Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
To learn more about Daniel and all of the incredible things that he does, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. If you have a spare minute and could do us a favor, please rate and review and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps people to find the show. If you'd like to support the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. We are on Patreon. It's patreon.com/speciesunite. I would like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knudsen, Natalie Martin, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, and Anna Kallner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.